Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwartztrauber. On today's show, should the FBI need a court order to look at your browser history? When it comes to internet metadata, data about who you send things to and receive messages from, what should the standard be? And should the FBI be allowed to access some of this information without even getting a warrant? Is this in the spirit of our Constitution? Should there be more oversight or less? Joining me to discuss this are two excellent privacy-minded folks from the Center for Democracy and Technology, Gabe Rotman, Deputy Director of the Freedom, Security, and Technology Project at CDT, and Yaja Butler, Privacy, Surveillance, and Security Fellow at CDT. Folks, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having us.
So before we jump in, let's just define the term that is being used here and the jargon that we'll be using for the rest of the show. It's electronic communication transactional record, that is ECTR. And the FBI is asking for what has been referred to in tech reporting as the ECTR fix. Can you explain what an ECTR is and what the FBI is asking for?
Sure. An ECTR is essentially your digital fingerprint online. It is every transaction, every communication that you have, or every record of that communication that you have. So, for example, whenever you type something into your browser, you send a signal and you get a website in return. That is an ECTR. So ECTR includes your browsing history. ECTR also includes all of your email records, whom you send emails to, whom you receive emails from. It includes, in some cases, your location. If you are using location tracking for some of your apps or from some of your devices. And it could also include things like all of your text message records, very similar to your email records, only it's whom you are texting. So an ECTR is essentially a record of everything you do online.
Right. And just to differentiate, when we talk about metadata, things like ECTRs, we're not actually talking about the content of a message, right? So they can't read the actual email per se. That might come under a different authority in surveillance law. But you can certainly glean a lot from an individual based on who they send messages to, who they receive messages from. And we talked about that a lot in the context of the bulk metadata phone program that was shut down. That was perhaps the biggest offender revealed by Snowden. And that was really some of the only surveillance reform we've seen since then. That was, who am I calling and who am I getting a call from, but not the actual call.
That's exactly right. And one thing I would actually point out is that even though it is not content, it can in many ways be a lot more revealing. In fact, one of the main differences between content and metadata is that content lies and metadata can't. Metadata is every record that you have, and it's every truthful record that you have. You can't hide your metadata.
Whereas, yeah, the content of a message could be pointless or useless, right, or unintelligible. Now, Gabe, what is the FBI referring to when they say they just need an ECTR fix? I mean, they've referred to this as the equivalent of fixing a typo. Is that an understatement?
Well, it's not a typo. It's not a mistake. It was a very deliberate choice made by Congress. Three times, actually. So the tool that we're talking about here is something called a national security letter, which was authorized under the Electronic Communications Privacy Act of 1986. And you can use a national security letter. It requires no prior judicial review and can be issued now under the authority of any special agent in charge of an FBI field office. So it's effectively a compulsory process. You must hand over these documents without any prior court review to make sure that to act as a check against abuse or misuse. So when it comes to the typo issue, it's actually moderately interesting because what happened was in 1986, the statute, which is 18 U.S.C. 2709, included the term electronic communications transactional records to distinguish between basic telephone toll records that are held by a wire provider, and these are all legally defined terms, using toll records held by a telephone provider. But then in 1986, because you had these nascent, you had the beginning of what has become the modern internet, Congress wanted to make sure that you could get the equivalent of the records that you could get from a regular old telephone provider. They wanted to make sure that you could get the equivalent from electronic communication service provider. So that's actually why it has the term electronic communication transactional record in the statute. Then in 1993, they passed an expansion, a slight expansion of the NSL authority following the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. And in that, they changed it to make sure that the FBI could get not just the telephone toll records and things like name, address, and length of service from an individual that they suspected was an agent of a foreign power. They wanted to make sure that they could get the records from an individual who's communicating with an agent of foreign power. And so that's the typo that the Department of Justice and FBI is referring to. And in fact, in 1993, when that language was inserted into the statute, it was strongly supported by the FBI and DOJ. And in addition to that, in 2001, in the Patriot Act, they further expanded NSL authority. And they again ratified, obviously the Department of Justice and FBI supported the Patriot Act, and they ratified what they're now calling a typo. So the issue, it's been a long term piece of the law, and it's not a typo at all. It was a deliberate choice by Congress and by the Department of Justice and FBI at the time to limit the scope of NSLs to metadata held by regular old telephone providers, but also they wanted to make sure that you could use an NSL to get the equivalent from internet providers or electronic communications providers.
And it's interesting that you went through the timeline there, because we're talking about the aftermath of two terrorist attacks, both on the World Trade Center. And generally on this show, we've talked about the dangers of legislating in a panic. That's how you ended up with the Patriot Act being so widely interpreted that its author, Representative Sensenbrenner, has now come back, 15 years later and said, I never would have thought that this is what would have happened. Basically, mea culpa, let's fix this, all that. So even when emotions were running high, and even when there was probably a bias towards more surveillance, less oversight, you still had these basic layers of oversight ratified. So now, 15 years after the 2001 item you just mentioned, what is the crisis that the FBI needs solving by saying that you can just write a letter? I mean, we're basically talking about an employee of the FBI writing a letter, going to his buddy at the water cooler and saying, hey, can you like co-sign my lease, basically? I mean, this doesn't sound like there's a lot of oversight here. It's the FBI getting approval from the FBI. There's no independent third party. What is this crisis that they're saying needs to be solved now, if 15 years ago, right after 9/11, they said that the status quo was okay?
Your guess is as good as mine. The problem that I have with this claim that they need this information is that they can already get it, and they can already get it quite easily. If it's a normal criminal investigation, as Gabe said, they can get Ector information from 18 USC 2703D. And that's an order that can be used under the same standard as they are supposed to be using for NSLs to obtain this Ector information, the difference being they have to do that before a judge. They could also use Section 215 of the Patriot Act to do the same thing. Again, it is relatively the same standard. The standard is that they have to have a statement of facts proving that there are reasonable grounds to believe that Ectors are relevant to an investigation. And when you think of that authority, you have to really consider what the term relevant means and understand how broad it already is. Yes, you have to go before a judge. Yes, you have to actually say why you want this information. But it's quite easy to prove that something is relevant to an investigation. So really the difference here is perhaps they want this information without going before a judge, and they currently can get the information by going before a judge.
And I guess by removing the relevancy requirement, would that just make a mass surveillance easier? I mean, is there a big complaint that right now their surveillance actually has to be targeted?
Well, it's not even removing the relevancy requirement. It's keeping the relevancy requirement. You just don't have to go before a judge to
right. So
prove
you don't have to convince anyone other than
yourself.
Your colleague, which is basically yourself,
right,
that it's relevant. And I guess, yeah, that could lead to all sorts of problems. I mean, there are probably critics of the surveillance state that would say relevancy equals someone being a Muslim, or at least like when the NYPD has had some checkered history with what they think is relevant to an investigation. So that already sounds like a pretty low bar. I mean, should we even be talking about this debate in the contours of what the FBI thinks, or should we be talking about more oversight, making it harder than it is now? I mean, are there... Let's assume that the FBI is right, that the status quo is a problem, but that you might actually go swing the pendulum towards privacy. Are there things that you would like to see as policy experts that would actually make it more difficult to get Ectors?
Well, before Gabe answers that, I do want to say that the NSL system as it is already broken. It has been abused many times in the past. I believe it was in 2007, the Inspector General of the Department of Justice actually came out with a report that conveyed in great detail the amount of abuse that has ridden our NSL system. Cases where the FBI has used an NSL to gain information about someone who is not reasonably suspected of being, you know, related to an investigation of terrorism or counterintelligence. That is the standard for NSLs. They found many cases where the FBI has used one NSL to gain Ector's and other NSL information from thousands of people. So it's one of those things where it's almost as if the system is already broken, but they would like to make it even worse. And that's our main concern here.
Yeah, and I would also just say, so NSLs have been controversial for exactly that reason for years and years, because judicial oversight, you know, it's not a question of malice. It's when you don't have these checks and balances, just as our, you know, this is the way that our system of government works. You have power checking power, ambition checking ambition, and when you have those checks in place, you minimize even the possibility of a mistake. I think it's also important to emphasize just how different the language that's being proposed is from even the current law. The typo that they're referring to, it's a bit of a misnomer to say that they can't get Ector's under the existing statute. They can, but the Ector's that they can get are limited to things like name, length of name, address, length of service, you know, and then the equivalent of toll records. And toll records are records that the phone companies kept to determine who was calling whom for billing purposes. So there really aren't analogs so much in the electronic, in the digital realm. But what they're asking for here is communications, routing, addressing, and transmission information. And we've said that's dragnet language. It refers to any time you interact with the internet. You're creating a transactional record of requesting a web page or sending a text message, you know, or sending an email. And that language is also, it's not limited on its terms by modern technology. So you could have actors that we can't even contemplate in the future that would be covered by that language. So it's much, much broader than was ever intended by Congress in the original National Security Letter Authority that was passed as part of ECPA in 1986. I think it's really important to get to just how broad an expansion this would be in terms of the type of records that the FBI could demand under its own authority without any prior judicial review. And then let me also point out one additional aspect of NSLs that's been very controversial. They come with a gag order. So once you get them, you can't tell anybody. You can tell an attorney, but that's it. Then the attorney can't tell anybody. So the chance of an NSL being challenged is lessened because of the fact that there's this gag order on anybody talking about the fact that they've even received them.
And that's been a big sticking point for tech companies, because they have an incentive to inform customers when government is requesting data on their customers, and they want to create an impression that there is due process and that there was a reason the data were swept up and all that. And I think companies are really annoyed by the fact that they could just get a ton of letters requesting all sorts of stuff and they can't tell anyone. And even if you cynically assume that they don't give a shit about rights, that it's mainly about their bottom line, then fine, it's affecting their business. I mean, you've got people in Europe who are just completely skeptical that American tech companies have products that are not completely tainted. And though they keep coming back, that might not happen. And you have the potential for an entire market of just non-American tech products to be invented because people are so skeptical. So if a company like Twitter or Facebook or Google just has a gag order and they're getting requests for all sorts of information, they can't tell anyone. That's a problem for their business. It's a problem for their duty to uphold, you know, to fight for the Constitution when individuals might not be in as good a position as a $600 billion company to fight for constitutional protection. Those gag orders are really problematic. Now, it's interesting you've brought up ECPA several times, because we've talked about this on the show with your colleague, Chris Calabrese, who's been leading the charge to reform this for forever. And basically, to bring listeners up to speed, the 1986 law shockingly did not imagine exactly how the internet would play out. And basically, since the invention of cloud storage, the idea that people are deleting emails after they're 180 days or older is absurd. And right now, you know, law enforcement's able to basically look at emails that have been opened and then left in an inbox for 180 days. Everyone agrees that's outdated. The problem with passing this basic reform has been things like this that get attached on. So right as we're talking about reforming a 1986 law to put a basic constitutional check, a warrant requirement there, the FBI is saying that ECPA reform is great if you add on ECTR or if you do this. So where does this stand? Now, we keep seeing the ECTR fix as an amendment, right? It's been tacked onto this, it's tacked onto that. There were some developments after Orlando. Can you guys discuss a little bit about the politics of this amendment and how it's been shopped around various pieces of legislation that don't necessarily have to do with it?
Right. So I'm so glad that you brought up ECPA reform, because this was something that essentially killed any chance for that going forward, so long as this was attached, because the ECTR fix undermines all of the protections that we're seeking to put on our emails and seeking to update our laws based on a 1986 law that really should have been updated a long time ago.
Right.
So right now, it is out there, this amendment. It's an amendment that can be attached to a lot of different things. Most recently, they attempted to attach it to an appropriations bill. That attempt very narrowly failed, but narrowly is the key term there. It is still very much out there. It is still very much a possibility. It is still something that its proponents are backing and attempting to move forward every chance they get. So right now we're being alert, we're waiting. There are a lot of senators out there who are very much against it because they understand the risks as we've laid out. For example, Senators Wyden and Heinrich are today actually conducting an ECTR Day of Action, an ECTR Day of Action to inform people about what this means and how dangerous it could possibly be. They're going so far as to answer questions about it live on Twitter and Facebook today. So it's a very polarizing issue politically. A lot of senators hate it. A lot of senators don't understand it. So we're hoping that as more and more people are informed and are aware of what this would actually mean in terms of the FBI's authority, and keep in mind, it could be Clinton's FBI soon, it could be Donald Trump's FBI soon. How they conduct themselves with an authority like this, is your guess is as good as mine. And that's something that senators and representatives should be aware of.
And Gabe mentioned earlier that this comes at a particularly critical time because, you know, the internet's only 20 years old. The metadata that could be collected now might be very harmful to a user. It could get much more expansive if you talk about things like the Internet of Things. I program my coffee maker to make coffee at a certain time, and that's stored on the internet in some fashion, or I interact with my internet-connected refrigerator. I mean, the potential for ECTRs to really create an almost completely comprehensive view of a person and who they are and what they do, you could find out all sorts of things. And there's also a lot of issues about information sharing. We had a former CDT guy who now is at the Constitution Project, Jake LaPerruque, on the show. And he talked about, you know, after 9/11, the refrain was, all the walls need to be torn down. All intelligence needed to be shared. And that was sympathetic because one of the, arguably the things that led to 9/11 was the fact that people weren't sharing information or analyzing information properly. But he proposed a chain link fence because you got to have some type of wall. When the NSA is collecting information for a terrorist investigation, then finds out that some guy was selling drugs and now he's being prosecuted when that was a foreign surveillance authority that led to that drug arrest. Like, there's all sorts of really murky issues here. People could very well wonder why, like, is this ECTR going to be used against me for some petty crime after the reason they found out about it was because of a terrorism investigation? I mean, are there real concerns around ECTR about how the information is shared with non-intelligence agencies? And the FBI is kind of both. It's both a counterterrorism and a local domestic law enforcement unit. Is that something that, are you guys concerned about ECTRs being used against people in prosecutions for minor crimes?
Well, that's exactly the problem. Right now, we're seeing many, many examples of using surveillance authority for the purpose of counterterrorism as a way to create sort of an end run around the Fourth Amendment. And that's obviously something that we don't want, because there are certain things that afford an exception to the Fourth Amendment, things like counterterrorism, for example.
Emergencies,
exactly. And then there are other things that clearly deserve that protection that we're promised as American citizens under the Fourth Amendment. And I'm glad you brought up the Internet of Things, because that is yet another example of how this could completely fly in the face of protections that we understand that we're supposed to have as citizens. The home is supposed to be this special sacred place where you can conduct yourself as you like without fear of unwanted surveillance unless there is some sort of special procedure, going to a judge and obtaining a warrant based on probable cause. As soon as that goes away, what is the Fourth Amendment worth, really?
Yeah, it starts to really raise questions about whether those warrant protections are just symbolic, because, you know, we hear a refrain from law enforcement community often that the internet is somehow different. And it's really important for folks like us and others in the privacy community to be like, do you want your internet history to have the same basic protection that a letter in a locked desk has, or an unlocked desk? I mean, should the warrant to get into your house now mean they can search everything on the internet? I mean, there are some serious questions, and I think we need to use those real world analogies, because otherwise people will say, you know, you get the I've got nothing to hide. You have the generational gap between people who live their entire lives on the internet and people who just, you know, signed up for email at the age of maybe 85 and don't really care. There are a lot of really important issues here. And for someone who's just coming of age now and has basically had a digital footprint or like a popcorn trail behind them their entire lives, this is very concerning.
Yeah, and let me just underline that point, because I think even with the state of current technology, if you think about one of the more interesting points here is that the FBI and the Department of Justice have said that when it comes to your web browsing history, they'll only look at top level domains. So if you go to the New York Times, they'll only look at whether you've gone to the New York Times. They won't look at which article you clicked on.
Right.
Under the language of the Ector fix, quote unquote, as it's been proposed, it would not be limited. So they could change their minds on that. But if you think about were they to change their minds, even that, as the more granular that you get when you're talking about web browsing history, I mean, it's clearly sensitive.
Yeah.
Right. That even that you've just gone to Planned Parenthood or the fact that you've gone to a suicide prevention website, all that's sensitive in and of itself. But once you start getting granular in terms of which subdomains you're accessing, you can start really sussing out sort of very, very nuanced information about one's political views, one's romantic entanglements, who one hangs out with. And that information telephone toll records were sensitive even in 1986. I mean, that information is even more revealing, as, you know, Yaja was saying earlier, that information can be even more revealing than the content of an email that you write.
Yeah. I mean, what you can assume from someone who reads the New York Times is maybe a certain reading level or a certain level of education. What you can glean from all the articles they've read, you could turn anyone into a criminal. You could turn anyone into a terrorist. I mean, listeners, just think about what you've done in your life. Have you ever looked up something weird? You know, have you ever Googled something just for the hell of it and been like, well, shit, I hope no one ever finds out I did that. I mean, that's what we're talking about here.
Well, consider the insane chilling effect that could have. I mean, the reason we have progress in any society is because you have so-called dissidents who explore controversial views. And if people are afraid to do that because anything that, you know, challenges the status quo is inherently a risk to the government, then all of a sudden we all lose. And that's the key here. When people say they have nothing to hide, first of all, yes, you do. Everybody has something to hide. Come on. Yeah. But secondly, even if you don't have anybody to hide, even if you're fine with all of your browsing history, all of your email records being out there for your government to sift through, consider the people who may not pursue a new idea, someone who may not visit a place of worship or a political rally because they're afraid of being watched. When that happens, society loses. Oh, and that's why privacy matters.
Absolutely. And as Americans, it might be creepy if the FBI were to do something like this, and it might be annoying. But think about other countries where it's actually a life or death issue. And we always talk about on the show, whatever the United States does on tech policy, regardless of the issue, whether it's surveillance or business regulation or whatever, everyone in the world is watching. Everyone is watching our Department of Justice, our FCC, our FTC, because we play an outsized role, because we invented the internet, because of all these things, because we have all these top technology companies. So we might do something like this that the average person might never notice unless they are the victim of a BS prosecution, as we talked about earlier. But think about a Chinese journalist, a Russian journalist, a Russian activist, those NGOs that we send all over the world. You know, why the State Department is constantly telling people about the importance of encryption when they go to an oppressive regime to do advocacy. So we need to put ourselves in that context. And Russia and China and other surveillance abusers who even put us to shame in some ways would love nothing more than for us to get these issues wrong so that they have us to point to say, well, if the Americans are doing it, certainly it must be okay. And that's not what we want. And just to wrap up, you mentioned that today is the day of action. Just in case this episode doesn't go live on what is today, we're talking about Monday, July 11th. And certainly listeners should check out that day of action on Twitter, the aftermath, depending on when this goes out. And Gabe, I know you mentioned you have a couple written pieces coming out that you'd like to plug.
Yeah, so I'm hoping to get something out soon on the history of this section to directly address this whole typo issue and explain that in fact it's not a typo at all. It's a very deliberate choice by Congress to make sure that at the very least there's a neutral judge looking at requests for these records.
And you mentioned also The Intercept, a Glenn Greenwald's publication that's very focused on this issue area. Recently released what was, I guess, classified guidance on how to use national security letters. So if listeners kind of want to get a sense of how the government thinks about these and how they, in the you know, whatever oversight exists or doesn't exist, that would be a good thing to check out. We can link to that in the show notes of today's episode. And we'll also link to the blog post that you guys wrote, which prompted me to reach out to you and ask you to be on the podcast. Is there anything you wanted to mention, Yasha?
No, that's basically it. One thing that I do want to highlight for listeners, if they really just want to get a quick and dirty version of this issue and why we have a problem with it, is a document that CDT put together called Correcting the Record. We noticed a lot of misstatements happening throughout the debate over the Ector fix when they were attempting to attach it to that appropriations bill that I mentioned. So we took those statements and we did what we could to clarify or correct what was said. So for example, one thing that was said was, you know, they can't get access to these records. As we've established in this conversation, they can. In addition, they can get them quickly through an emergency provision of the USA Freedom Act. So if anybody wants to learn more about those types of issues and why, you know, maybe if a senator voted yes for cloture, they should be able to switch their vote to no if they, you know, clarify, you know, what really is at stake here.
Yeah,
and definitely check that out.
And just so listeners know, this amendment failed by only one vote the last time that it came around. So we are really teetering on a cliff here. And all it takes is someone to switch and the filibuster is gone. So if you have thoughts on this, if you're passionate about this and you want to let your senator know what you think, please do. Even if you are pro-Ector, it's good for people to be engaged on the issue. But that's it for today's show. My guests have been Yasha Butler, Privacy, Surveillance, and Security Fellow at CDT, and Gabe Rotman, who is the Deputy Director of the Freedom, Security, and Technology Product at CDT, that is the Center for Democracy and Technology. Folks, thank you so much for joining.
Thanks for having us.
Follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Send us an email at media@techfreedom.org. Tell us what you like, what you didn't like, guests you want to hear again, topics you want to hear again. Find this podcast in the iTunes store and please, please, please leave a review because it will really help others find the show. That's how that works. I don't know how it works, but that's how it works. Algorithms are crazy. And that's it for today. Thank you for listening.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.